You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And on this episode, we are bringing you an author chat with Naomi Shu Elegant, who joins us to talk about her debut novel, Ginkgo Season. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners over on Patreon. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and would like to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official supporter, you can gain access to our members-only Discord server. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the ability to help us pick a book club pick once every quarter. So yeah, as always, we appreciate everyone who's joined us so far and hope to see more of y'all there.
Yeah, so we had a lovely chat with Naomi about her debut novel, Ginkgo Season. It is a literary fiction novel that is kind of like a slow burn, I would say, as you can tell from the title, Season. Mm-hmm. So it's part love story, part coming of age, and part political awakening, I would say. We talked to Naomi about a lot of these things, and I hope you guys enjoy our chat.
Yeah, so without further ado, please enjoy our conversation with Naomi Shu Elegant.
And we are here with Naomi Shu Elegant, who is a writer and journalist living in New York City. Her work has appeared in Monocle, Fortune, Atlas Obscura, and elsewhere. She is also the co-editor of Gully, an independent literary magazine. And we're here to talk about her debut novel, Ginkgo Season. Welcome to the show, Naomi.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Yeah, so I like to start our conversations with a little icebreaker. And your main character in Ginkgo Season, Penelope, she has kind of like a hyperfixation on Napoleon Bonaparte. And I was wondering if you had like a historical figure that you've, you know, kind of went down the Wikipedia rabbit hole.
This is such a good question. And honestly, like probably one a week and it's, you know, every week for a lot of my life. Definitely when I was writing it, when I was researching her character, it was Napoleon because I had to learn about him to make her obsessed with him. But a big one, like maybe my first one when I was a kid, was Bucephalus, who's Alexander the Great's horse, who lived like almost as long as him and was his like trusty companion. And I just think it's crazy that there was a horse that lived like 3,000 years ago that is almost as famous or more famous than so many human beings. And yeah, I was obsessed with Bucephalus.
Yeah, when I was reading your book, I was like, Napoleon? For me, I'm like, Napoleon was such an asshole. And like, people don't realize that the whole like Louisiana Purchase happened because of Napoleon.
It's crazy,
because
right?
he tried to bring slavery back to the French colonies, and like Haiti was like, hells no, and they like revolted and they kicked his ass so hard that he was like, okay, I'm gonna give up my colonies and sell it. Because yeah, so I was just like, Napoleon.
No, yeah. Imagine if like the middle third of America was just France now instead. That would be crazy.
I think my theory is that French people, who, you know, they're very proud of their language, and rightfully so. It's a beautiful language. But I think they're salty that French is not like the default international language, like
for
English.
Sure.
Yeah.
It would be like a huge Quebec. It'd be crazy.
I mean, not to get too deep into the historical weeds, but wasn't like French the official language of all the monarchies in Europe for like the longest time?
Yeah, like the Russians would speak it and everything, right? Like in Tolstoy.
Yeah, it was like a high court French language. Yeah.
They've fallen from grace.
As you can tell, we're all nerds on this.
Yeah, we could just talk about this the whole time. We don't even need to talk about the book.
And, you know, let's be honest, like, you know, current situation, our country, in full like view, like history is kind of written by assholes, right? Like it's,
yeah, and starring them most,
yeah,
of the time,
right? It's, so you know, there's a reason why he's endured the test of time, and the reason why his name is also synonymous with like being a jerk,
but like an interesting jerk, right? Like he was smart. He loved books. He wrote a novel, which I gave. I quoted it as
like
the epigraph.
A romance novel for his debut novel.
I mean, he was a weird guy for sure, but you know, in an interesting way, yeah. Someone worthy of a rabbit hole, I guess.
All right. Well, you know, we always like to start off our conversations with our authors by getting a sense of, you know, how they became a writer. So, Naomi, can you give us a brief, I guess, walkthrough of your journey to becoming a published author?
So I think as we've already sort of discussed, I've been since a kid reading a lot of things, be it history or, you know, obviously a lot of novels as well. Was a huge reader. My dad is also a writer, so I kind of grew up around a lot of books at home and just it being a profession that is possible to pursue. And my parents were always very fine with whatever I did, which I think is very cool. Like when this came out, a lot of people were asking like, oh, like, how does your mom feel about it? Like, you know, Asian mom. I'm like, she's probably more chill than my dad, actually. Like, she's so happy about it, which is really nice. So I think being able to grow up just with books everywhere, reading all the time, it just seeming viable really helped. And then in college, it's probably when I started properly trying to write fiction and pursue it. And okay, like I'm going to sit down and write a novel now. And eventually I managed to do it.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you to like kind of give us an elevator pitch for Ginkgo Season in a bit, but it is your debut novel and it is set in 2018, 2 years into the Trump administration's like first term as president. And, you know, now it's 2025 and your book came out like in May. So is 2018 when you started writing the novel, or was it something that like you worked on earlier and just kind of like kept working at it over the years?
I actually started writing it in 2021, 22. So it was during the non-Trump administration, during Biden, where at that point, you know, it seemed very much like the Trump administration was like a thing of the past, like a weird one-off, which was kind of made it interesting to write about because it felt like Trump happened and then COVID happened. So it really felt historical in a weird way. Like it felt like it had happened. There was a big rupture and it happened a long time ago. And obviously by the time it was published, that had turned out not to be true, but I still see it as kind of a interesting capsule of that first administration, which anyway is so different to the second one, right? And I lived in Philadelphia at the time. So I wanted to set something there because it felt like a very particular moment in, I guess, American history. And again, that turned out to be true because it's still really different now. So it was kind of, yeah, trying to make this capsule of something I experienced. I was there in college, so I was younger than the characters in the novel are because they're in their mid-20s. But yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I was really curious. I was like, oh, did she write this as like a contemporary novel, or was it like she looked back and set it in 2018? Because it was like a very like eventful year.
It really was.
Yeah, and it just seems so weird that like that is now like technically history, you know, history. Yeah.
Even the fact that like, 7 years ago is sort of hard to wrap my head around, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, even like 2020, that was 5 years ago, and
insane to think about.
Like it's nuts to think about how like so many authors we've interviewed a lot of authors on the show, and many of the debut ones, they started writing during the pandemic, and it was just like a chance for them to really just, you know, because there's like absolutely nothing to do. So they're like, okay, let me like work on this novel that I had in my head for a long time. So like, did you kind of have that same experience? What you said you were writing this in 2021. So what was your writing experience like?
I definitely did have that experience. I wrote a novel that has since been discarded in 2020 with all that free pandemic time. And then I knew kind of even when I was writing it that it was going to be bad and that it wasn't going to be something that I was going to try and publish. But I wanted to just prove to myself, I guess, that I could write a long project. So that was like an achievement in itself. And then after I finished that and put it away, I kind of felt ready to start on sort of the one that is now Ginkgo Season. You know, I felt a bit more confident in myself because the prospect of like, yeah, writing 60,000-70,000 words is pretty daunting if you've only ever written a 2,000-word short story in an undergrad workshop.
I mean, and 2018 is just, it's an interesting time period because it's, you know, post the first Trump election. We have to say first because there hasn't been a second, but pre-pandemic. So it was a time when a lot, because, like, you know, our podcast was, we had our first episode September of 2016. So, like, we like started right before the 2016 election, right? So we kind of had the experience also, like, the activation of a lot of people realizing that, like, the world that we thought we lived in was not the world that we are in, right? And kind of come to terms with that. And that's something your characters do a lot in your book. I want to, you know, touch more on that as we talk more about the themes. But like we were mentioned, can you, you know, for our listeners who are may not be familiar with what your book is about, can you give us a brief synopsis of Ginkgo Season?
So Ginkgo Season follows a woman named Penelope who is 25 and she lives in Philadelphia. She works at a museum. She's Chinese American, but she kind of grew up in China and then moved to the U.S. So she's kind of has one foot in both countries a bit more than other Chinese Americans, maybe. And yeah, when we meet her, she's kind of living a very, like, quiet, normal, routine life. She's recovering from this heartbreak and she doesn't really want to take any chances. But then she meets a guy in the museum office who kind of throws her off guard. And that's kind of the inciting incident, or the meet cute, to use the rom-com parlance, that sets everything else in motion. And it kind of, like, shakes her out of her comfort zone, and we follow her as she tries to grapple with just all of the stuff that uproots, I guess.
Yeah, this book is definitely, like, I think it captures the struggles that a lot of mid-20-somethings people, like, grapple with, because I feel like it's just, you've, like, graduated, like, college, or, like, you're past your teen years, and now you're supposed to kind of, like, be on the path to adulthood. And I just, like, because Penelope, she has, like, a bad breakup. She had, like, she had that one bad ex, and you know, now she's kind of drawn to this new guy, like you mentioned, Huang, who is like, who she meets in, like, a meet cute. And I'm just curious, like, what do you define as love in your mid 20s? This really,
well, starting
messy
with
time.
The easy questions.
I know.
I think love is consistent across ages in many ways. I think I was interested in, yeah, kind of the second love. Like, I think when you're that age, everybody, like you said, has that one bad ex or that one big ex. Maybe they've fallen in love once, or maybe not at all, but it's still pretty early stages, right? And especially now, like, you're not going to be maybe thinking about marriage and kids yet if you're on the early 20s side of your mid-20s, I guess. But it is also a new phase. You're far enough from college that you start to feel like you're moving in a different direction, and you're worrying about stuff that maybe you wouldn't have worried about even just 2 years prior or something. So I think also with Penelope, she's kind of, you know, she broke up with her ex quite a long time when we met her, but a lot of people do get stuck on these things because it can be hard to meet people, and then you just kind of idealize this past relationship. So I wanted to make it, like, it's not even a love triangle, but just sort of like the person competing for her attention with this new guy who's so great is just someone from her past. Like, he doesn't really appear for, well, no spoilers, but, you know, he's absent for at least the big beginning part, a lot of the novel, but he's kind of still, like, in her mind. And I feel like that's such a common thing that people experience, and that's something that I really wanted to explore. It's like she's holding herself back using this, like, phantom, you know, version of this love that she has actually lost a while ago.
Yeah, I think you definitely capture, like, the being in your mid-20s and kind of, you know, I'm in my early 40s now, and looking back, like, I did some really, maybe not dumb stuff, but, like, not well thought out things. I, you know, you're still trying to figure out who you are, trying to figure out what you want. And, you know, in your 20s, you've had, like, some form of experience. And for a lot of people, that is, like, the sum total of their, like, experience with, like, with love, with society. And again, this 2018 setting is so interesting because, so, you know, I graduated college in 2006. So, you know, 2 years into my early 20s was, like, the global financial crisis, right? Everyone suddenly realizing, wait, we can't have a house anymore, right? And I think 2018 is kind of similar for, like, the generation that graduated in, like, you know, 2015, 2016. And a lot of your characters are, like, kind of dealing with, like, this shift in kind of their worldviews. And I think, yeah, you did a really good job. Like, on one hand, I'm like, girl, you got to get over this guy. It doesn't sound that great. But on the other hand, I can understand, like, for her, that was, like, her, that was her future that she needs to let go of, right? Or the future that she thought she was.
Yeah, and it's
have.
Like a comfort, right? To kind of hold on to a past relationship. It's almost like the safe option.
Yeah.
But I also feel like when you're that age, and I mean, hopefully again, you know, throughout your life, but I think when you're a teenager, you have like the most intense first love experiences and like the crazy crushes where you can't look at them in the eye and things like that. And you're obsessed about them and just talk to your friends about them more than you talk to the actual person. And I just really love the idea of that happening again. You know, she's been through like a long-term relationship, super intense. They live together and you feel a bit more adult. But the fact that that kind of teenage type of crush can just strike you again unawares is just a very appealing experience to me.
Yeah.
And I wanted to portray that as well.
And I kind of like how you made Hwang into essentially like a manic pixie dream guy, because like the Mikyu, he's just a guy who like he doesn't want these mice to be killed in the lab, so he sets them free, which is a very like free-spirited thing to do. So I thought that was a really interesting like twist on that trope.
I love that trope. All the movies were like, we're now critiquing them, that came out like 10, 20 years ago, like Garden State and stuff. When I was like a teenager, I was like, oh my God, I relate to this guy so much, like blah, blah, blah. So I was like, what if we did like a gender swap version of it?
So you mentioned that you used to live in Philadelphia, like when you were in college, and your book is very much a love letter to the city. Like it is like so descriptive with like the architecture and like the history of the city. So like what makes Philadelphia like so special to you, and also to your character Penelope? And I'm also like curious, since you like wrote it when you were not in Philadelphia, like what was that experience like writing about a city that you haven't been living in for a while? Because it's definitely a different city compared to like present day Philadelphia versus like your Philadelphia that you like lived in.
Totally, yeah. I wrote the book when I was living in Hong Kong and Singapore and Malaysia. Like, I was kind of bopping around a lot, so I was really far from Philadelphia. But it was kind of nice because it gave me this frozen in time image of it, of the time when I lived there, because it has changed so much in, you know, like 6-7 years since I've lived there. And that was also a nice snapshot that I wanted to capture, you know, because it was such a specific time. But no, I do, the love is genuine. I love Philadelphia. I think it's a very underrated American city. I live in New York now, and obviously New York is, you know, very walkable, which I love, and has a lot of history. But Philly is also very walkable because it's really old, obviously. There's really beautiful architecture everywhere. She spends a lot of the book kind of walking around and thinking about architecture and buildings, which is something you can do there. You know, there's stuff from like the Revolutionary era, and then there's like really cool 19th century, 20th century stuff. And it's like a history lesson all over the streets. There's like beautiful parks. It's a lot more affordable to live in than New York as well, which is a bonus. And because she's so interested in history, I thought it would be cool to have her live somewhere where there's so much history around her. There's also slight tangential like Napoleon connections randomly in Philly that I mentioned a bit in the book. But yeah, I think it's a good place to set a novel because it's kind of the right size for this kind of story, with like a small cast of characters. They walk around and talk and think a lot. New York, I don't know, it's been overdone. Like, we've read so many New York novels, so it's time for a different one.
Yeah, maybe it's because I've watched National Treasure so many times, but I was just like, I recognize the buildings described in this book. Yeah, it is like very.
I should have had them try and steal the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah,
like little heist in the middle.
Yeah. So let's talk about Penelope's job. So she is an archivist for the Bound Feet shoes from like the Qing Dynasty at this museum, and I thought that was like such a specific job to have, like as a character. So like, why did you decide to give her that profession?
I think I've read so many contemporary novels where the person just works in like a really nondescript office job, which can be a really good detail because that is so many of our lives. Like, it's accurate to modern life, right? But I thought it would be more fun to write something with like a lot of texture and like physical objects even in detail, just because it was fun to write, first of all. And also because I think, again, like it tells us a bit about her character. It's also based on, I took a class when I was at college where we visited like a museum and saw all these bound foot shoes they had in the archive. And it was a very striking experience. And I've always wanted to find a way to put that into fiction. So I'm really happy that I finally got to do it. But yeah, I think it's just interesting to, you know, in a novel, you can kind of get them to go anywhere. So you might as well get them to go somewhere that you might not be able to go to in real life, like the restricted archival collection of, you know, a made up museum and their like obscure artifacts that they collect. Because I think, yeah, why not, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, I thought it was interesting because being an archivist, like, you have to be very, very detail oriented, and like everything is so organized, right? So I thought that Penelope, she tends to like compartmentalize and intellectualize a lot of her feelings, and she's a very introspective character. So I thought that was like a very fitting job for her to be this archivist for this very specific time in history. And yeah, it was just like her idea of letting the guests like hold the bound feet shoes like in their hands. I was like, oh, I've never actually seen anyone do that. That would be like so cool. So I was like, oh, that's definitely an exhibit that I would go to.
Yeah, I know. They probably wouldn't let you do it, but
oh yeah,
I agree. Yeah, that's also based on me like being able to hold them within the class that I went to, and it was like, oh my god, like it was crazy.
They're so tiny.
Yeah, they're so tiny. They're so light. They're like lighter than baby shoes. I mean, it's like totally insane to think about. And yeah, I guess I wouldn't say that the book is like about like her identity that much, but it's obviously like woven through everything. And she has like, you know, connections to China, and obviously that's where bound foot shoes happened. So I thought it would be a nice thing to kind of have that cultural element as well. And even just the fact that, you know, a museum in America could have hundreds and hundreds of pairs of these shoes, which are such intimate objects, shoes and socks of Chinese women from like 100 years ago, is sort of a weird thing to think about in itself. So I wanted to, yeah, just put her there and see what she does in the room.
Yeah. I mean, identity is still definitely a big part of, you know, something I really liked reading was how you captured like this, you know, when Chinese people meet each other, there's this initial kind of sussing out of like how or what kind of Chinese you are, or how Chinese you are. It's like whether it's like where you're from, where your family's from, how well you can speak the language, and then, you know, whether or not like when to speak Mandarin in front of each other. And I think he did a really good job kind of capturing how we relate to each other when we like see each other in the wild. It definitely felt like came from like a very like personal experience place.
Definitely, yeah. Those were really fun scenes to write as well. And I think especially like when, like, so Apple, which is her best friend, she's Taiwanese American, but like fully grew up in the US. And then Penelope has one American parent, one Chinese parent. And then she has this roommate who's more like mainland Chinese than she is. And I always thought that it's like, it's very fun to have those different types of Chinese people also interact with each other, which I feel like I haven't read a lot about in fiction, but I've like experienced in life and seen. And it's always like this funny social dance, like you're saying, of like, you know, the hints and like, okay, the accents and like all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, even back in like the early aughts, like that was like the first time I met another like Taiwanese person or another Chinese person in college. That was like kind of like the initial kind of just, okay, we need to figure out exactly what your Chinese lineage is, and then we can kind of figure our relationship to each other.
Or even like I remember in college, like the West Coast Asians and the East Coast Asians meeting for the first time, and they're like, you know, their lives are so different. So it's almost like they're different, like, yeah, like they have an umbrella group, but your experience is so different if you grew up in like a town in Massachusetts where you're the only non-white kid versus like California where there was like maybe one white kid in the whole school. So I always thought that was, all those dynamics are so fun to think about and write about.
Yeah.
So you mentioned Apple and Penelope's like Taiwanese American friend. And I really found Penelope's friendships with Apple and also Inno to be really fascinating, because those two characters are so loud in their personalities. And, you know, in a way, they're like very self-centered. But at the same time, they're like the biggest supporters of Penelope, and they do show up for her while being a consistent source of drama as well. So like, how did you come up with these two friends, and like how did you balance them with Penelope's like more introspective personality?
I mean, it definitely was a question of balance, because like you said, she's a pretty interior person. She spends a lot of it thinking. It's like in first person. So we're in her head a lot. And I think just for the novel to like have forward momentum and action, I needed people around her who are more action takers than she was. But I also think it is a pretty common friendship dynamic, right? Like there are those really nice friendships where an introvert and extrovert kind of find each other, like the cat and the dog. What do they call it? Black cat, golden retriever, like yeah, that kind of friendship.
Black cat, golden retriever, yeah.
And I like that dynamic. And I think it is a real thing in friendships where, like, even if it's unspoken, the shyer person kind of gets something from the loudness of the loud person by just being able to follow them around and like into the situations that they wouldn't otherwise have entered because of their shyness. And then the loud person maybe has a sensitive side that with their other loud friends couldn't come out, but with their more quiet friend can actually like simmer in the quiet moments. So I think there's like a mutual, there's like a symbiotic reason that those personalities attract each other. Also, again, like it was just really funny to have her be in these situations with these like very dominating friends who also don't like each other and like basically can't be in the same room together.
I was like, that is so accurate. You cannot have like two like Rottweilers like going going at it. Yeah, in a friendship.
And then you need the peacemaker, right?
Yeah, especially like we mentioned in this like time period, 2018, where like a lot of their interactions are kind of in reaction to, again, the first Trump presidency and election. And you have like, I think the phenomenon that a lot of us experience with our friend groups as well, which is like we're finally having like to talk about politics as adults and talk about our stance on things and what we are and aren't doing. And like I feel like your book really does capture those like those conversations where everyone's trying to do the right thing, but also not sure how far they want to go, not sure how much of themselves they want to put into it. And, you know, a lot of Penelope's journey throughout this book is kind of figuring out where does she land in this as well, as someone who did not grow up in the States, but is a United States citizen and in essence also has a responsibility, civic responsibility to it, like in that sense too.
Definitely, yeah. And like, I feel like I've read a lot of books where the character is super like politically unenlightened and at the end they're sort of enlightened. And I find that arc really interesting, but I kind of wanted to set out to write a book where at the end, it's not like she like realized the light of whatever ism. You know, she's still the same person, and I don't think like her personality would ever be someone that's like really sort of like strident about her political views and like reading, I don't know, like going to meetings or whatever. But she is sort of drawn to some kinds of political action and like participation, but for like more interpersonal reasons or more practical reasons, like she just feels like that's what's right, rather than thinking, oh, I have to do this for this XYZ ideological reason. And obviously both ways are real ways that people are in the world. But I wanted to try and write someone who was, I guess, like, quote unquote, apolitical, which so many people say they are. And then like kind of play with that a little bit. Like, what does that mean when you're like face to face with this stuff? And when you're surrounded with friends who very much identify as not that.
Yeah, I mean, like, everything is political. Let's just get that out of the way. So like when people say that they're apolitical, I feel like, you know, they're like pretty much until it affects them, they're not gonna like put their input in.
Yeah, totally.
And that's kind of like what Penelope is. And she's just like, I like, even though technically I'm a U.S. citizen, like I didn't grow up here, like I don't really see myself, you know, being on a soapbox and provide and like pitching my opinion in. And like, I just thought it was interesting how she, like, joined this unionization protest, because that is actually, like, a very big political thing. And she got, like, pulled into it because she knew people who were going to, you know, unionize. And, like, the guy that she likes works at this hotel. And I thought that was, like, so relatable, because people get involved in, like, local politics because it affects the people that they interact with. So I was like, oh, okay, this is like very, very relatable.
Definitely, yeah. And like she kind of did it also at the beginning to impress him, basically,
to
right? Like her motivations weren't the pure making the world a better place. But then it's like, if the outcome is good, you know, even if it was trying to impress your crush, it's still a good entryway, I guess, to that kind of thing.
And yeah, I mean, she could have dropped it at any time.
Yeah, she could
too. Like the commitment to the bit was like, Wow. Okay. Maybe you are a better person than you give yourself credit for. And I just thought that was funny because Apple and Eno, like, they have like these corporate jobs that, you know, they hate. And it's very typical of someone who's like starting out in like a profession that is in the corporate world. Like, you're trying to be a good person, trying to use your resources ethically, but also like not be destitute. And it's like, how can you be a good person in a capitalistic society? And I thought that was like a really fun contrast to Penelope, who's just like, I'm gonna try to stay out of politics, but also like she's putting in the work to go to these protests and to actually be involved. So yeah, I thought that was like an interesting friendship dynamic.
Yeah, you mentioned sort of the friends with the corporate jobs and how they're trying to contribute in some way. And I remember at that time, around 2018, is when I first started hearing about effective altruism, when it was still like pre like the kind of crypto associations that it now has, like very early days, because like one of my housemates was like talking to me about it. And so I wanted to give one of her friends, Eno, that philosophy, but then make it also kind of incoherent. Because I think a lot of the time, even the people who, you know, read a lot about stuff and have very strong opinions, if they're pressed, their kind of political stances are pretty jumbled up and don't really make sense if they had to explain it all at once, because it's kind of just like a lot of vibes mashed together. But that is like how most people are. So I wanted to also have fun with that and have, you know, Apple and Eno have like really strong opinions, but then kind of when pressed a little bit, be like, oh, well, like, I don't know. And then, you know, maybe their actions don't always live up to their words, which again, like, is probably all of us, right? But in different ways than Penelope.
Yeah, like I've had friends who graduated from business schools and they like went to go work at like these big firms, and they're like, my contract is for like 5 years. I'm going to make as much money as I can in those 5 years and like break free and actually do something good with my life. And I'm like, I mean,
and a lot of them just don't quit after the 5 years.
Yeah, they don't quit.
I've heard that too.
I know literally just like one person in like my friend group who actually like went through with quitting their big like corporate investing job and went with like their passion jobs. I was like, oh, okay, a rare breed.
Yeah, the golden handcuffs are real.
Yeah. So like, let's talk about like the romance. So one of the reasons why like Penelope is drawn to Hwang is like his candor. You mentioned like in their Meet Cute, he confesses that he saved lab mice that were supposed to be euthanized at the expense of like his research job. Like, he doesn't lie. He doesn't hide the fact that he did this to his superiors and he gets fired. And it's kind of like, as a reader, you're like, who does that? Like, who is that honest? Do you not have any self-preservation? And I feel like with Penelope, like she has an interesting relationship with honesty. She tends to distance herself a little bit from the truth, whether it's like by omission, like not sharing personal details, or like small lies, like, you know, she lied about, you know, being a Chinese citizen, but it's like she's actually a US citizen, but at the same time, like, does it really matter in the end? So like, what are your personal thoughts on like how honesty is applied to like romantic relationships?
Definitely important. Definitely recommend it. I think with her kind of omissions, like you were saying, and her general closed offness, I wanted to write a bit about how even when you're not actually actively lying, you're just kind of letting people believe something or maybe not correcting something, it can still create an emotional distance between you and other people, because even if it seems like small little details, you're really not showing your true self. And those things kind of accumulate to like a shell between you and the world, even maybe without you noticing. And so I think someone like her needed to meet someone like him, where like it would never even occur to him to lie, right? Like, he, to the point, like you said, of losing his job and like potentially just not being, it might not have been a wise decision, but he's just not the type of person that would do it. And sometimes it is that simple. Like, some people just are honest and it's like instinctive to them. And I think if you're someone that overthinks a lot and is always worried about what other people are thinking or what they're thinking of you, it's very disarming to meet someone who genuinely just like goes about the world really naturally. And it can be really inspiring. And I think that, you know, maybe her seeing that was the first spark of like her interest in him. because it is such an appealing personality. And yeah, with love, I guess probably we are also drawn to people who have attributes that we admire that we don't have ourselves, right? Because you want to always be escaping yourself when you're in love. Like that's the best version of love. You're like leaving yourself for a moment if you can.
Yeah, and like what's interesting about Hwang is that he doesn't have a phone. And in this day and age of like Google and, you know, Apple Pay, it's kind of like unbelievable, right? So like their relationship, they communicate by writing these letters, by like postcards. I'm curious as to like how did you come up with this idea as part of like their relationship? It's like, okay, they're not gonna have text messages or you know, like this is the only way they're going to be able to communicate.
I think part of it was wanting him to have some of those manic pixie dream guy qualities, you know, and maybe being like a little bit inaccessible, but in a romantic way. And I guess it's another way that he's sort of slightly apart from people she's met before, you know, apart from the modern world. But again, like in this attractive way, right? Like, oh my God, how can you live like this? Basically is the question that we ask about him, but in a good way. Because you hope that there's people around the world, and there are, like, you know, walking around still without phones somehow. Although I feel like it's probably harder now than it was even back then. And then another part of it was probably just practical. Like, I'm writing another book now, and it's also set in, like, you know, modernish world. And I'm, like, always writing sentences about, like, he picked up his phone and he looked at his phone, because that is a reflection of how we live life. But then I'm like, oh my God, like, this book is just about people picking up their phones and texting. So I think having a way to not have that be the basis of all their interactions was also like really useful. I worried that maybe the letters would be a bit too twee, but I actually love writing letters, and I think it's very romantic, and I think it's something that you can do. The postal system still works, it's realistic. And I think it also, again, like put their relationship in this different light to the rest of her life. Like it's kind of happening at the same time as her normal life, and sort of separate and a little bit magical in that way, because they're communicating this really archaic way that they don't really have to be doing. Like he could get email, he could get a phone, but it's like they're both kind of buying into it because they want to kind of both feed that fantasy and that thing that they're building together, which hopefully,
yeah, it's very intentional. Nice. Like you actually have to put in the effort. It's not like DMs where you can unsend or delete your chat, right? It's like once you send it in the mailbox, it's gone, it's done. And when you're writing it with like your hand, it's also like very intentional as well. It's not like, I feel like with texting, we're it's like so automatic sometimes, right? But when it comes to like actually thinking out what to write with your hand, it's like, okay, like, you go through the thought process of like, this is what they're going to be. This is the final draft of my thoughts. Whereas like with texting, it's like very much like word vomit a lot of the time. So.
Definitely. And like you can always unsend, like you said. And it's very intimate because, yeah, I think people don't really write letters as much nowadays, but people maybe still journal and write in diaries. So writing a letter to a person almost feels like you're writing in your diary, which obviously is so personal and so intimate. And it's like a physical object that the, you know, person you have a crush on has touched, right? And then you're holding it in your hands. I've read a lot of kind of older correspondence back when letters were actually the only way that people talk to each other. And so much of people's letters from the past is just saying like, got your letter on this date, I sent mine on this date. Like it's just updating about letters themselves, because it's like the objects were actually so important, not even the content necessarily. Like you'd have a postcard that would just be like, sending this from here, just got yours. And it's like, just an update. But it meant so much, you know?
Yeah.
It was Instagram stories back in the day, you know? It's like, here's where I am. I'm alive. Proof of life. Wish you were here.
Yeah, like when you find out that Hwang only, he doesn't have a phone and they can only like talk through the mail. Like that was just like, that was when the manic pixie dream guy like kind of thing clicked into my head. And also like I didn't roll my eyes in the bad way. It was more like if I'd met Hwang in real life, I would also roll my eyes like, get a load of this guy. Right?
It's like a guy that carries a film camera around or whatever, right?
But also, you know, there's something charming about a guy who's just like so uninterested in being involved in like, you know, contemporary life.
And it works out because Penelope works at a museum. She works with historical objects.
So yeah, like, exactly. Yeah. She doesn't mind. She's very analog.
Also just a pretty genius, like, I guess, writer trick too, you know, because the speed in which the post travels does play into, you know, their relationship as well. So
many, you know, Romeo and Juliet, right? All of the correspondence timing issues. Like, texts are instant. We've lost so many plot devices.
Yeah. Yeah, but just because you can text someone, and like with phones, like, there's like, you're accessible all the time, right? But at the same time, that's not true, because she like communicates with her father, her narcissistic, artistic father, who likes to take drugs, hallucinogens, and kind of like disappear off the grid for a while. Like, she communicates with him on WeChat, and, you know, it's like, even though it's instantaneous messaging, it takes a while for him to get back, and he doesn't even like answer her questions like half the time. So I thought that was like a really nice juxtaposition of like, okay, like, postcards versus talking to my dad on WeChat, and him being like, hey, guess who's a Potter now, and it's like, okay, like, more context, please.
Also such like a relatable like Asian American child immigrants thing is having multiple messaging apps on your phone, one for your parents, because I too speak to my parents exclusively on WeChat.
They're not going to switch to anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm Korean, so like the app of choice is Kakao, and I just like make sure I like that app is only for family. Like, everybody else is on Line or Telegram. It's just like, I can't.
You just have to have like 6-7 different apps on your phone at any time.
I need to compartmentalize my relationships like by like messaging apps. That's the only way I can like keep sane. But I thought Penelope's relationship with her dad was like really interesting. And it's very rare that we get like a parent who is like an eccentric artist, you know? So like, why did you decide to make their parent-daughter relationship like that? Same thing with, like, her mom, because her mom's also, like, absent, and it's because of mental illness, and that's not really something that we see in literature commonly.
Yeah, I think I wanted, you know, when we meet her, she has these really close friends, but she has the breakup, and she is, like, a little lonely, and I think the fact that she doesn't have a support network of family to fall back on in the way that a lot of people do is part of that loneliness, right? She's a pretty self-sufficient person, but it is because her parents were sort of, like you said, eccentric, or like, you know, had their own issues. And I think growing up with those kind of parents can make you a certain type of person who's very responsible and, you know, pays your bills on time and has a good job, which are all good qualities. But it also means that you know, you have like a sadness because you didn't get to like be a little crazy or like take risks. You know, maybe the reason why she's so risk averse is because she grew up with the parents that she did. At the same time, it's, you know, I don't want the dad to be like a villain or anything. You know, she loves him. They do have a relationship, because that's also like a reality, I think, when even though you have this sort of parent that you wish would be a bit more like a parent, you know, you have your relationship with him and the dynamic is what it is. And you bring it into adulthood, and you're not gonna like get mad at them, or maybe you are. But this particular person wouldn't get mad at him, I guess. But that also means turning a lot of those negative feelings inward to herself, which I think is something that she does a lot, just bringing things inward rather than sort of confronting him, which would be another valid thing to do. But yeah, I think it's a sort of emotional response that is common that I wanted to explore, even though it seems like a non-response. I think actually is one, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And, you know, like, Penelope's tendency to like omit the truth and kind of like distance her way from like being completely honest, I feel like that is very much the environment that she grew up in, because her parents aren't straightforward either, and that is like so common in Asian families. Asian immigrant families love secrets, you know, they just love dropping them, like dropping some lore when you're an adult and you're like, I don't remember any of this happening.
Oh, yeah, like
childhood.
Really nonchalantly being like, oh, by the way, and it's like a life-shattering revelation.
Yeah.
Classic.
Okay, so like, we're winding down to the end of our conversation. This is my last question for you, but Ginkgo Season is such a beautiful title for a book. I love ginkgo trees. I mean, in the fall, it looks like gold has just covered the streets. I was just interested in knowing if that was like your original title or if you had like a different working title when you were working on this book.
You know, I think you're actually the first person that has asked about the title, which is kind of crazy. I didn't have a title for most of the book, and I thought of the title pretty late, like almost when I'd finished writing it. And I honestly just couldn't think of a title. And I might be like fabricating a memory, but I think that it was autumn and I was like visiting Japan, and I was like down one of their ginkgo avenues, like you said, when it's so golden and just like one of the most beautiful things in the world, right? And there is a ginkgo tree appearance in the book. And I think, I don't know, I struggled for a long time. I wanted to come up with something not so literal, like, but just more of like a vibe. And I think it does sort of give that, hopefully. Like, I think people, without specifying, have realized that it means the golden season, because it really could be like any season, right? I remember my editor was like, when you say ginkgo season, like, which season are you actually talking about? Because it's not specific. But I think people do get that it's like meant to be the golden one, which is sort of when the novel takes place. But yeah, I think very vibes-based, very image-based, this idea of like a sort of quiet beauty, which hopefully permeates the novel, is something that I wanted to evoke. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on your debut. It was just a lot of fun just to read about, like, just go back to 2018 and like relive like these experiences through the eyes of like this group of friends. And yeah, I guess, you know, your debut novel is out. You mentioned you're working on your next book. Can you give us a brief teaser on there? Or is that all under wraps right now?
I'll say there's a love triangle
okay.
with three people who are in the book, and there will be more inter-Chinese and inter-Asian American social dynamics that hopefully will be entertaining and funny.
Awesome. That's music to my ears. Well, Naomi, thank you so much for joining us on Books and Boba. Congrats once again on your debut, and yeah.
Thank you so much. This is such a fun conversation. Thank you.
And that was Naomi Shu Elegant. Her debut novel, Ginkgo Season, is available now at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Boba online bookstore. So if you enjoyed our conversation with Naomi and are interested in picking up her book, you can do so by going to booksandboba.com and checking out our bookshop link. As always, all purchases made on our online bookstore support not only us at Books and Boba, but also your local bookstore. So definitely appreciate everyone's support there. All right. Before we call it an episode, Rira, can you remind us what book we are reading for July 2025?
Yeah, sure. So we are reading Pingzu for Two by Sujin Witherspoon. And this is a patron's pick from our Patreon Honey Boba member tier. And Marvin specifically asked for like a summary read for this month. So I think our patrons nailed it. You know, Pingzu is shaved ice. It is very summary. It sounds like a fun read because it's an enemies to lovers coffee shop romance. So,
yeah. So as always, we are doing a read-along for all of our patron supporters over on our Discord. So be sure to check out the book club pick thread for our reading schedule. And for those of you not on our Discord, you can still let us know what you think of the book by going to our Goodreads and letting us know there. But yeah, with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again to Naomi Shu Elegant for joining us. And we'll see y'all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Life gets a little crazy sometimes. Sometimes it's confusing, sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's beautiful, and sometimes it can just piss us off. Enter First of All Podcast. It's a safe space for real conversations about the things that we all struggle with, celebrate, contemplate, and work through in our daily lives. I'm your host, Mindy Chang. I'm an actor, filmmaker, and entrepreneur with a colorful background, a full life, and brilliant friends who I love to unpack life with to share with all of you. They are everyday people like you and me, ranging from award-winning artists, cultural icons, powerful CEOs, my hilarious childhood friends, and even my mom. Tune in for honest conversations on mental health, dating, sex, family, career, culture, and everything in between. Listen to First of All wherever you find podcasts, part of the Potluck Podcast Collective. Life gets a little crazy sometimes. Sometimes it's confusing, sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's beautiful, and sometimes it can just piss us off. Enter First of All Podcast. It's a safe space for real conversations about the things that we all struggle with, celebrate, contemplate, and work through in our daily lives. I'm your host, Mindy Chang. I'm an actor, filmmaker, and entrepreneur with a colorful background, a full life, and brilliant friends who I love to unpack life with to share with all of you. They are everyday people like you and me, ranging from award-winning artists, cultural icons, powerful CEOs, my hilarious childhood friends, and even my mom. Tune in for honest conversations on mental health, dating, sex, family, career, culture, and everything in between. Listen to First of All wherever you find podcasts, part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.